Notes on the initial contact interview with May Goldman, January 18, 1973. This interview was to explore the areas of activity of the interviewee. It seemed that she was involved only in the 1915 suffrage parade, but there was some possibility that her education and professional background might be of interest. She was involved, as mentioned, in the 1915 suffrage parade as one of the contingent of Barnard students. Other than this, she was absolutely not involved at all in other suffrage activity, although she quite obviously was an ardent feminist. She did not believe in marriage, but did marry. In fact, during her sophomore year at Barnard, in order to have her husband exempt from the draft, she also had a child for the same reason. After she finished Barnard, she essentially stayed at home until 1928, when she felt she wanted to get out of the home, went back to school, and thought of becoming a teacher. When it was obvious that this didn't suit her, she eventually got into social work. This, however, was not until 1928 or 1929. She pursued this career for something like 13 years only, during which time she apparently became involved in the attempt to form a union among the county employees, which would encompass the social workers, nurses, and maintenance workers. There is some interesting information about the number of Jewish girls who were at Barnard, and some of her own ideas, which are of interest. However, in terms of her actual activity, either in suffrage or her involvement in trade union or the professions, there's very little material here. No further interviews will be pursued.
They were, as a very young child, I know my mother, I remember some of the stories my mother told me. See, my folks were Russian Jews, and I remember my mother was always not active, but a great sympathizer with the Russian revolutionists. My father, of course, escaped the Russian army by escaping to America.
You were born here?
I was born here. And they were married here. They met, they met and married here. No, they met and married here. And so I was brought up in an atmosphere of union, the rights of all people. It wasn't, I can't say it was distinctly, from my mother's point of view, women's rights. It was the rights of all people. And the union was a very strong thing. I remember at that time, Eugene Debs was the big man, and he became an idol of mine. Anybody that participated in the Russian Revolution was an idol of mine. Marvelously, the things that they told me. I remember the story my mother told me about one particular revolutionary woman. She was the daughter of a general, and how she had been tortured when she was caught to tell about the others. It dates way, way back. And so, but somewhere along the line in the early days, I became a I don't know how to put it. To the point where I got to the point where a woman had to stand alone. That was all that I could. I remember very distinctly. I was just beginning to go with my husband. I was a young kid, about 15 at that time, and I wouldn't even let him take my arm. I could walk alone, that kind of thing. So, otherwise, I did not participate in anything until I came to California, pretty nearly 50 years ago. I My attitude towards marriage is what the kids have today. At that time, I was married at the end of my sophomore year. The school didn't know it. Pardon?
When was that? What year?
1917. And I went to school. They didn't know I was married. I didn't tell them. It was none of their business as far as I was concerned about it. And as a matter of fact, I had to quit the last semester when I was to graduate because it was a toss-up as to whether my child would be born before or after commencement. It just happened he was born 2 days later. I quit then, and I didn't go back until he was 15 months old, and I graduated in 21. And that's about...
Well, how did you get involved in the parade?
Through the college. All the women's colleges were participating that time. It was one of these big things. It was an all-day affair. And as I told you, I just don't remember. It was right in line with my thinking, but nothing of my own making. And for some reason or other, all I can remember is that Inez Mulholland led the parade on a white horse. That's about it. We marched on Fifth Avenue, New York. You probably know things.
Is this the parade that left from Washington Square?
Yes. It's the big 1915 parade. It was the history-making parade. See, excuse me, I think I guess...
You were at one of the women's colleges at that
Barnard.
Time? At Barnard?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Barnard is the one that's
probably
in New
Columbia.
York City.
Yeah, it's across the street.
And each college marched with its own banners?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Each college, each union, each group, each organization marched with its own banners at that time. It's so long ago that I've forgotten. That's when I graduated, 1921. When I actually finally graduated, I belonged to the class of 1919. I went back to the 50th anniversary of that class 4 years ago.
Now, you don't remember anything else about the parade itself then?
No.
Were you involved in any suffrage activities after that, or the parade was the
only? No, as I told you, that I was not active in anything. I was married and I had a child, and I came to California when he was 2 years old. And it was after that that I began to get active in little organizations here. Not organizations specifically for women's rights at all, but generally, the rights of all people.
What was your attitude when you were, say, at Barnard and around the time in the parade and then when you got married about the position of women and what you...
As I say, I've always been very... That's why when Women's Lib came along, I looked at it and I thought, well, what is this? They suddenly woke up. It's something that I fought for all my life. I mean, in my own life, I fought for it all my life. And I only began to give it acceptance when I realized that movements move awfully slowly. And it took for 50, 70 years till it came to the passage of the Women's Suffrage Act. And it took, at that time, I know that everybody thought, well, if women will get into it, things are going to change overnight. Well, it took 50 years. Now they're beginning to wake up, women. And it has the advantage now of being able to pull in a lot of women that it didn't at those days. But to me, I look at it askance. I look at the young people. My attitude towards marriage was what they have today. It was no different.
What can you describe in more detail what your attitude towards marriage was?
I did not believe in marriage at the time. My parents didn't believe in it. They were eventually married through peculiar circumstances, and I finally married legally, you know, legalized it, because it was the First World War, and the draft was approaching my husband's age. He was then 31, and they were approaching that age. And so So it was felt that at that time they wouldn't take married people. And then I became pregnant also, purposely. so that he wouldn't have to go to war. I remember more running around to the different rallies against the war. Everybody in school began knitting in classes. In classes they were knitting. I don't know how they do now. But they were sitting, and it was permissible because it was for the war. And I sat there, and it got to the point where you kept your mouth shut. You couldn't. And I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't mature enough, both in knowledge and in personality, to fight it, to dare to speak. Well, I kept my mouth shut after the final suppression of it came about because she was declared a traitor. So I would sit there and keep quiet, and they'd all knit around me.
You weren't involved actively, like with Women's International for Peace or Freedom or any of the other anti-war groups?
No, I was not in anything at that time.
How old were you when you became married then?
I was 20.
And it was, if it had not been for the war and the draft, you feel you wouldn't have gotten married?
Oh, no, I didn't get you don't understand. No. I legalized my marriage. I did not approve of marriage to start with in those days. But 4 months later, I did because of the draft. That was what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's why I say that when I see what the young people are doing today, it's nothing new to me. It so happens that in New York State, and I did not know, I became a social worker here about 1928. And I discovered through a case that I had that New York State considered at that time any relationship where the woman took the man's name and was known as his wife, maintained a sort of a family relationship, as a marriage.
There was no time period involved. Hmm? There didn't have to be a time period
involved.
No,
apparently not. And it was a common law marriage. That ended in 1922, I think September 1922. I didn't know that until, as I say, I happened to have a case where the man had deserted the woman here in California. She had two little children. She was pregnant. And she gave the new baby, when it was born, away for adoption. And I traced her husband to New York. And we had him, what do you call him? Had him bring the girl back.
Extradited?
Hmm?
Extradited?
Extradited, yeah. Sheriff went and got him, brought him, and on the way he mentioned the fact that he was never married to her. So I questioned her. She laughed. She says, "Of course we were married. We got a license." But I discovered that she had never gone any further than the license. So I had to prove that this child, this oldest child, was his, because he was trying to deny it. And in the court, the prosecuting attorney, who was a woman then, said, although we questioned whether she was legally married, he said, "It makes no difference in New York State's law." And he granted her a divorce then and there. So I became legal anyway.
What, can you elaborate on your specific ideas about marriage and why you didn't believe in marriage?
First thing, I'm not religious. I'm an atheist. That immediately solves it. And I felt it was distinctly a personal affair. It was nobody's business. I could not see somebody saying abracadabra over me, "Give me the privilege of getting married." It was all. When I finally went through the ceremony in the City Hall in New York, I felt rather humiliated by it. That all of a sudden this man who had been saying, it was during the war and a lot of soldiers were getting married, and he sat there and he was saying this abracadabra with his eyes half closed, and I really felt offended by it. That was no way. That's why I say that to me it was something I had to agree to. Nobody could tell me. And not being religious, there was no rights about it. And at the time, actually, I wasn't aware I think I'd have been more rebellious if I had known how much the woman, or how little the woman's rights were in connection with marriage. I probably would have raised a storm there too. I didn't really know it. So that's what I bumped up against now, 50 odd years later, you know. That's about it. That's
but you were interested in, you did believe in the nuclear family. You were interested
in a nuclear family. Just what do you mean by a nuclear family?
In having your own family with your own children and no other people involved in terms of a larger set of relationships.
I don't quite get that meaning.
You were into it?
Yes. Oh, yes, but I felt that that was something that, as long as it lasted, was okay. If it fell apart, well, it fell apart. That's just too bad. That was all. And I have the same feeling today when I see people raise a hand. When a couple gets a divorce, the young people get a divorce, it's terrible. But if they've been living together and then find they can't, nothing, they've just broken up. And to me, that makes no sense. That's all.
What, your family were Russian Jews. Mm-hmm. From what part of Russia?
You know, I really don't know. It must have been near the Polish border, somewhere.
So near Brest-Litovsk, in through that area?
I don't know. No, my mother came from Minsk. My father came from small country places. I do know that when he went to the big city, Minsk was the city. So he couldn't have been too far away. That must have been the biggest city there.
They come from very
religious backgrounds.
But they themselves were not Orthodox.
No. My mother... my father was the middle of three boys. And in the Russian army, they didn't take the oldest. And the youngest... They didn't usually take the youngest son either. But he also was very, very tall, so there's a heart condition there. And my father was the only one. But it was always known, I don't know if you know anything about the Jewish custom, a man has to say his morning prayers every morning with a prayer shawl and with phylacteries, you know. And I understand that every time Dad was cut a pair, he always lost them. It was something... The strange part about it is this, that my grandfather was very religious, but for some reason or other, he had a peculiar respect for my father. So Dad got away with it. I don't know how and why. I don't know when he really lost it. Evidently, he didn't care about it there. My mother, on the other hand, was a religious type of person. While she was there, she was religious. And when she was religious, there were no half measures. I mean, there was no hypocrisy about it. You either were or you weren't. But when she came to America, she lost it. And socialism became her religion. When I say socialism, that means the welfare of the human race, people, the unions, manner of living, because she also had to work in the shops in New York, in the sweatshops. And so she lost completely. So in that atmosphere, I grew up. I knew very, very, very little, although all the relatives were immigrants. I saw very little of the Jewish rites, religious rites, because we had none of it in the home. I knew very little of it. I saw more of it when I got much older. And all I can say is that, like any child that's influenced by the family, I was influenced, but I later made it my own. In other words, I finally arrived at it through my own convictions.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I'm the only child.
Wasn't it rather unusual in those years, particularly for a Jewish family, to be going, for you to go to college?
No. No. That's something you have to know about the Jewish people.
Well, I'm Jewish.
Oh, then you ought to know.
Well, I thought it might have been different then, because I know in terms of my mother's own
education,
generation.
The book.
But
well, for boys. Well, but you see, my folks were liberal in that respect. But by that time, I'm trying to think. It is very possible. It's economically, any other members of cousins couldn't go. Still, my father's brother's son went to college. He had an only son. He was 10 or 11 years my junior. I guess that's all, because our family wasn't very big. And if they didn't go, it was for, if the girls didn't go, it was for economic reasons. That was all. No, college education was the thing.
Now, how large was the student body at Barnard then when you went?
I think it was about 800, in the neighborhood of 800, because our class had about 200. And it's just the one class.
Were there very many Jewish girls among the women there, do you recall?
Many of the outstanding girls were Jewish girls. You know who went to that time, if you know any of them? Let's see. Babette Deutsch is a poet. She wasn't in my class, she was earlier. One of the girls in my class is, she goes by the name of Elner Gluck. She is married.
She's a sociologist.
She's married to Sheldon Gluck. Let me see. You know, there's some more that I know. Ginsburg. Oh, for God's sake, she died not long ago, and she was active with the, what's this other, you see, I'm getting old. Memory fails me, words fail me. Oh, for goodness sakes, this other anti-war movement.
The Women's International?
No, it's men and women belong to it. For God's sake, there was nothing here.
Hmm.
Especially, and girls that, of course, the wealthy girls always do. But there was quite a group of girls, and apparently among them quite a lot of Jewish girls, who went to the Ethical Culture High School. They were a very fine group of people. And they were there.
Now, was your family middle class by this time, or did they have to really sacrifice for you to go to school?
It was always a sacrifice. It was always. My father was, when you say middle class, he had worked himself up into a little business. But as we know middle class today, it was still a struggling affair. He was simply his own boss, but it was still a very struggling affair. At a bar, sometimes from Peter to pay Paul, you know, to get me. At that time, college entrance tuition was $200 a year. That was a lot of money. That was a lot of money in those days. And it was a big sacrifice, but there was no other thought of anything. I mean, it never occurred to anybody it would be any different. Well, I never, that was my trouble, in a way, my downfall. I never went to work until after I was married and had a child.
So you didn't, after you left Barnard and then when you came out here, you didn't work at all then?
I never worked until I came. The only work I did do, if you want to put it that way, my father was an optimist. And a venturesome man. And for some reason or other, he was always in hot water. We had in a small town, Irvington on the Hudson, we had a little stationery store, newspapers, paper route stationery store. But we also had a boarding house in the summer, for summer people. There's a story as to how we got to that, but so in the summertime, he and Mother had to be there. And so I, and a cousin of mine was a partner in the business, in the store. So summers and after school hours, I had to work in the store. So that was the extent of my working. I never got paid for it as such. until, as I say, I was my son was about 8 years old when I went to work for the first time.
When you went to Barnard, did you live at home, or you then?
I lived at home. And that was another thing that wasn't so good for me. And you see, being a country girl, and being, there was another thing also. I lived in Irvington on the Hudson there. I graduated high school there. And we were the only Jewish family there. And I had known what it was to be discriminated against. And so I was at ill at ease. I didn't know how to conduct myself. Had I been able to live in the city, had I been able to live in the dormitory, it would have done me a world of good. It would have been more educational for me than the years of college that I went to. That's why I say that I was wide-eyed, and I was glad to see these things take place. To me, it was a wonder. Women are working for suffrage. Women are marching for suffrage. Oh, it was the days of the, what's the name of the women in England that was,
The Pankhursts?
The Pankhursts. They were tying themselves to posts, and they were getting arrested and things. It was a big doings in those days. And to me, they were all doing big things. They were making sacrifices for something. But I needed that wearing down of the polishing up, or I should say, that I didn't get, and that's where I lost out.
Now, just as a student of Barnard, then you became interested in suffrage. Was your family?
Oh no, that was apart from it. I came. No, no. I came to it with the feeling of women's rights or women's rights. I told you I wouldn't even walk in the street with my husband holding me by the arm. I could walk. I could stand on my own 2 feet. That was my way. I can do it. I pay my own way. I'll do my own things. I didn't need a man to do it for me. And it was a purely instinctive thing. No, I came to Barnard. I was thrilled that there were women doing these things. Thrilled to be even participate in the parade was a big thing for me. That's why I'm useless to you for women's suffering for all this idea. But you know something? My granddaughter-in-law, she's now teaching a course in criminology in Berkeley this semester. But she's been making a study of women, and she gave a course on women last year at the University of Nevada, where my grandson is teaching. And she's also interested in it, and I have been giving her some things, any literature that I found on women's right, women's, not women's rights in it, but women's participation. I've been feeding her books on it that she couldn't get.
Do you recall the kinds of things that you expected would happen to women as a result of suffrage?
Oh, wait a minute. Let me see. What do you mean?
And you obviously had expectations that this was all going to change things.
Of course, we all did.
In what kinds of ways?
Well, we all felt that women's approach was more supposed to be more understanding. What we found is the women actually, looking back on it, as I look at it, women were no different than the men. They merely got the right to do it. And it's the same thing today. Well, you see now they're getting the right to join the Navy. They're getting a right to be welders and truckmen and all that kind of thing. They got the right. Whether they are aware of something besides getting that right, it was a different story. And that's what, looking back, I can see what happened. But we didn't. Thinking mothers, you know, mothers understand these things. People, they want to see children fed, children get a good education. They're more concerned than men. Well, it didn't happen. And actually, I haven't altogether felt that it was the men that kept them down. I can't see why more women themselves didn't push themselves into places to go to college, to study law. They did. There were women who did it. So there's no reason why more couldn't have done it. More people could have gotten certain places and done it. That's all.
But you felt that initially, you thought that the world would really change, that it would become better if women...
Of course. Well, wait a minute. No. No. That was a byproduct of it. That was a byproduct. Initially, the thing was the unfairness of the inequality. That was just a thing that you sort of expected, but that was not the basic thing. The basic thing was that the right to do the thing, I have the right to say. And as I say, no different than today, when I feel mad that I couldn't make an investment when my husband is the head of the family in a state that recognizes community property and still tells you that you don't count. That's what I mean. It's the same thing.
Because I know a lot of women, there's a 104-year-old suffragist that I spoke to, and she was saying she never believed in the myth, that they tried to have the myth that women were morally superior, that there would be no wars, etc., if women had the vote. And she never believed that, but that a lot of women did really believe that.
Oh, yes, a lot of people expected that. There was a feeling that there would be change. And I think a lot of women felt, it didn't happen. But the fact is that we do sort of expect it. It's the mothers who are more concerned about the feeding of children, the saying to it that they're not neglected. Something just comes up to my mind right now. One of our women went to the peace conference in Japan, and she found that the Japanese mothers had formed an organization there to raise funds for the thousands of Vietnamese children that are wandering the streets, that have no homes. The men didn't see it, don't seem to see it. You try to put through something in schools, and the men seem to be the ones that are opposed to it. The women, the fact is, I think the women do, by and large, see these things a little more clearly than the men do. But that isn't the thing.
Your position was essentially just that it was unreasonable and unfair and unjust.
I could do just as well as anybody else. Why shouldn't I do it? Even in my relationship to my husband was always this, what would I do if you weren't around? I can do that. I can fix this. I can put that up. I can do this. And I can. But somehow or other, it was always that he could do it. Man is more accustomed to doing it. So I could even splice a wire, an electric wire. But it was a feeling that I don't know anything about, you know, but the man does.
Did you actively, throughout your life then, you actively learned those kinds of things then so that you could be more independent?
Naturally. I mean, I feel today, I mean, even among the women, I laugh. I laugh. I have an old washboard. I said, one of these days I'm going to tie a ribbon on it and hang it on the wall. I said, because if I have to, I can go back to scrubbing on the washboard. I can use it. I have the capability, the physical capability. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm physically able to do these things. Why not? More than the man can do. He hasn't learned to scrub wash on the washboard.
Did you have any expectations of having any sort of professional career while you were in college? Did you think in terms of
No. That, again, was part of my background, which was I wasn't exposed enough to know what there was to be done. I didn't want to teach, and I didn't know what professions there were. And having gotten married early, I didn't have the need to decide what to do. I began to get very restless after a few years. I thought, this is no... So I did go back to school, and I got a teacher's credential.
When was that?
In 1927. And while doing practice, in a practice teaching class, I remember standing there and thinking, how can I get out of this without looking like a quitter? But I don't like teaching. I'm not made for teaching. I don't have a how I'll put it. See, I know myself pretty well. My reasoning is what I depend upon. I can reason, but I can't, I'm not imaginative enough to devise things to do. Now, by accident, I got into social work, and that, I felt, I was in my milieu.
But you went back to school because you did want to
I wanted
find
to do
some
something.
Sort of...
Oh, yes, but I didn't know what. And had I didn't even know about social work. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I went to a New York school, but I lived in the country, and I was cut off between the school and in those days, by the way, school isn't the same as it used to be. We had to have Latin. Who needed that? The fear of Latin. 5 years of Latin, what for? It didn't add to my cultural background unless I specifically wanted something. And I am not, I'm not adept at languages. I don't quickly pick them up. Had I known more about social work, I'd have gone in to take courses in social work and gotten perhaps a master's degree instead of my teaching credentials. I do know what got me into it now, I just thought. Actually, what got me to it was this. I had a young cousin here, a youngster, came to California. She was my father, the partner that I told you in our business, their child. We did not understand why Grace didn't learn to speak. And when she did, it was peculiar. We couldn't understand it. And living in a small town, there was no facility for even questioning it. So the result was that she was left back and she pushed around from post to post. I don't know if you know what happens to a child like that. The expression, this child is a beautiful, lively kid. And she just felt that peculiar, dull, left-out look. It was pathetic. But they came to California. Financially, it was a misfortune for them. But one good thing came out of it. In school, they began to test her, and they found that she had only one-fifth hearing in one ear and one-fourth hearing in the other. That's why she never got sounds. So they put her in special classes in the summertime. It was during the summer vacation. And I worked with her constantly. I got her to the point where she spoke perfectly, but it needed, with a 12-year-old child, it needed constant nagging, keeping her up. And I felt that there was a place for me. But at that time, we were just approaching the Depression. Small communities couldn't even think of it. And the city was cutting down on its teachers, so there was no place for me. The meantime, I got out. Then, a year or two later, I accidentally got into social work because I learned that someone else I knew was taken on as a social worker. She was only a high school graduate, and I was one of the few rare birds at that particular time that had a college degree. So I got me a job. And that is the field I would take. That is the field I would work in. That is the thing that I would have taken more courses
in.
So my granddaughter's doing.
So you became involved then in social work professionally at that point and stayed with it?
Oh, yes. I stayed with it until I quit the job in 1941. I worked at it only really 13 years. I had no need for working later, and it was very, very hard. It had almost broken me. In the 30s, in about 1932, I knew that I was going to break, but I sort of thought it would be a nervous breakdown. Instead of that, I got pneumonia, and I barely made it. Times were very hard. The caseload was very, very heavy. It was just before they separated the welfare, the real welfare cases, from the unemployment cases. And it was hell. And I was carrying as high as 160 cases that I had to see every month, keeping the records and interviewing new people and interviewing other people in connection with each case. it was an ungodly job.
Were there many women, or was it mainly women?
Mainly women. It didn't pay enough. The highest pay at that time was $160. That was the highest. So it didn't pay enough. And then, I'll tell you when men began to come into it. They took in, the first batch of men that applied that were unemployed, somehow or other they worked a lot of those into helping in the SRA. And then they began to get into the social world. So then you began to have men. Otherwise, they didn't have any men in the field at all.
Now, when was it that you became involved in attempting to form the union?
Somewhere in the middle 30s, I don't remember anymore anymore, but in the middle 30s.
Now, there was no unionization at all among these people.
As a matter of fact, it didn't hold out, but apparently it had enough, because now they have a strong union.
And what was the union that you were trying to organize?
We were trying to organize the social workers and the nurses and the maintenance people into a CIO union. We were not knowledgeable enough, experienced enough, and that was a mistake. You don't grab up everything, take little bites at a time. And the social workers and the nurses felt superior to the maintenance people. They wouldn't belong. They wouldn't belong to a union anyhow, it was hard enough. But to belong to a thing like that was out of the question. There was no ideology there.
How did you go about trying to organize it?
See, I didn't work this alone. I worked with other people. Oh, brother, I don't remember even the details of that anymore. We called meetings to try to anything, try to talk to people. Well, that's what you do.
You were primarily talking to social workers.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Trying to get the social workers to join it. Well, this is a... At least the satisfaction I can have, I guess, is that maybe it was the first little spark that gave the big union its boost. I don't know.
Well, there were a lot of things like office employees, bookkeepers and stenographers,
unions in the
late 20s and 30s, which have just disappeared.
Uh-huh. Well, there was nothing in the county at all, but nothing. So we were trying to take in everybody. Mm-hmm. Anybody that felt that there was a union should be had. Well, we tried anyway.
Well, what finally happened? Nothing came of it at all?
I think it fell apart finally. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what happened. I had to get out of it. I think it fell apart. And I don't know. It may have just kept somebody, mm-hmm. kept a colonel until finally, you know. I've hung on to a Democratic club while it was dead as a doornail, and yet I hung on with my teeth, and it's spreading up again. So that may have been there. Somebody may have done that.
Yeah. And then you stopped working in 1941.
I quit working altogether.
And you haven't worked since then.
Mm-mm.
You had no desire to keep working at all?
No, I got active and I felt that I could do some organizational work. And as long as I could get along without my salary, I didn't see why not. I went back for a while and volunteered for the Red Cross.
During the Second World War?
Through the Second World War, for a while there. And I ended up taking psychiatric medical histories. And I was rather, I don't know whether amused.